Okay, so the last speaker of this morning's session is Felix Rey. Felix is a director de recherche at CNRS, but he's also a professor and institute pastor and head of the structural virology unit. He's done a lot of contribution studying structural function relationship, especially of viral surface proteins that induce membrane fusion. But also over the last few years, he's been very interested in emerging viral infectious diseases. And he has sort of adapted his approach of structural and functional biology to studying interaction of some of these emerging viruses like dengue virus, Zika virus, in terms of how they sort of operate in the context of infecting hosts or arthropods, for instance, vectors. So this is a nice example of how you can apply very, very basic structural biology into understanding pathogenesis of diseases. Well, thank you very much, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Philippe, and thank you for the invitation. It's an amazing meeting. I mean, I really, it's difficult to come after all these wonderful talks that we heard, so I'll try to skip up. And on top of that, Philippe asked me to be short, so I will. So this title actually. Yes, I know. But I'll try to be. I know we're all getting hungry now, and it's near lunchtime. So this is the title. Actually, is Hugues' title because mine was too long, and he rightly shortened it to something that could fit there. So I will just tell you about our latest results about Zika virus, but I will try to give you some of the context on where these results sort of become more pertinent. So you know, Zika virus is an so-called arbovirus, which means an arthropod-born virus. As Philippe just mentioned, there are a number of families that have arboviruses. These are the ones that have viruses that cause disease, and a number of them are sort of envelope viruses. And some, like the Rioviridae, this blue tongue virus is non-envelope, but it's another family. And they have a number of them have been really causing important emerging this later years, and we have been studying them for that reason. So Zika is a flavivirus here. This is the and within the flavivirus, the genus that also have the hepatitis C virus and others which are not arboviruses. So Zika virus has been known for a while, but it became of really broad recognition very recently, as you know. So just to summarize, flaviviruses are a group of small envelope viruses with a plus sense RNA genome, this single-stranded RNA genome, which encodes a single polyprotein that is the precursor to all of these proteins, and they cause diseases that are of global concern, as I just said, and the geographic distribution generally follows the distribution of the arthropod vector. So about 20 years ago, this was the distribution of these flaviviruses around the world with those transmitted by mosquitoes and those transmitted by ticks, yellow fever in Africa and South America, dengue that was spread all in the tropical areas, Japanese encephalitis in this region. And these viruses are transmitted by different mosquito vectors. For instance, now the mosquito that transmits dengue, it's found worldwide. This is Aedes, this tiger mosquito, Aedes albopictus, but also Aedes aegypti that you can find. And others are by Culex. But we don't really understand exactly. For instance, yellow fever can be transmitted by mosquitoes that are present in Asia. There have never been an outbreak of yellow fever in Asia. And in addition, recently there are many cases in Angola. There is an ongoing outbreak of yellow fever now, and many Chinese workers are there going back, and there is a lot of commerce, and nobody understands yet what other factors are controlling this transmission. So, but about 20 years ago, or a little less, in 1999, for instance, West Nile virus happened to go from Tel Aviv to the Jewish quarter in New York, and then spread this virus all over the Americas. It wasn't found in America before. It was originally from, as the name indicates, is West Nile, on this area, and then it had spread even up to Australia. And now it's all over the Americas. And Zika virus, similarly, so it appears last year in South America. So originally, Zika virus, I just took it from the web, was identified in 1947 in Uganda somewhere, in the Zika forest. Then in 1960, there were the first reports on the West Coast. Then in 1970, 1976, there were reports in India. And then a number of years passed, and we found it in Yap Island in Micronesia. And this was associated with cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome. And then this in Polynesia in 2013, and then in 2015 getting to Brazil, and you know, and there was a seminar by Arnaud Fontanet yesterday here, right? So I guess all of this is go too much, and so all of this it became known when in the Pacific, in the West Pacific area, about this Guillain-Barré syndromes, and now this microcephaly and other serious neurological syndromes, and the fact that it can be transmitted to the fetus in pregnant women. So, but in spite of all of this media concern about Zika virus, dengue continues to be the most important arbovirus disease. And so it is considered, although it was known, there are reports about from the 18th century about dengue viruses. Since the after World War II, and in particular from the 60s, the cases have been rising enormously. Here is like a million from 2007. And if you look at the global burden, you know that about 400 million infections yearly, 25% of them are symptomatic. And so you have this pyramid, like 2.5 billion people living in dengue endemic countries, 100 million symptomatic cases per year, about a million cases with severe disease that need hospitalizations, and of these, 2.5% die every year. You know, if you count all of the cases, I mean, the Ebola virus crisis, that killed about 13,000 people. Every year, dengue kills twice as much. And you know, malaria kills 10 times more of that. So we have to, it's just, when something sticks out like Zika, it's of course is a problem, but the media attention makes that the funding of the system, if you're working on one of these guys, you get more grants and not the others. And actually it's causing trouble on other serious diseases that we sort of leave aside because of the most. So the problem with dengue virus is that actually is not a single virus, but there are four different dengue viruses that are called serotypes 1 to 4. And the envelope protein of this virus is the sole target of the neutralizing antibodies. And with the difference, the most distant serotypes have about 35% amino acid sequence divergence. So they are like 65% similar, okay. So the thing is that infection by one serotype is thought to provide lifelong immunity against that serotype, but the antibodies that you make may exacerbate disease upon infection by other serotypes. So this has been a problem in order to develop a vaccine, because you might be putting people at risk of more serious disease when they catch dengue from another serotypes. And this is believed to be at least one factor of this, is that macrophages can become abnormally non-infectable by dengue virus, but can be become with by the Fc gamma receptors through polyneutralizing antibodies. And I will try to address that. So just about the biology, so the flaviviruses are all organized the same way. It's a single polyprotein. This is the open reading frame with the structural genes here, and all of these are the enzymes for replications that are inside. This is the cytoplasm, this is the ER lumen. These are the code gene that will present in the virus particles. The capsid is complex with the genomic RNA, and these are in the envelope proteins. And the polymerase NS5 and the protease NS3 and many others. So there are, for instance, there is a very successful vaccine, which is the yellow fever vaccine that was discovered at the beginning of the century, last century, which is used and protects you essentially for life. But the thing is that yellow fever is a single serotype. And now the vaccines that are being in trial now use this yellow fever background, into which this PRM and E, the structural, these two structural genes have been replaced by those of dengue. But there is not only one, there are four different, there is a mixture of four different vaccines, one for dengue 1, dengue 2, dengue 3, and dengue 4. And those have been in trial. And the problem is that this vaccine apparently does not protect in the same way against all of the serotypes. For instance, it protects quite well against dengue 3 and dengue 4. It protects less well against dengue 1, and it barely protects against dengue 2. And actually, it has been licensed now in Brazil and in Mexico, but for children that are over 9 years old. So in these endemic areas, by the year of 9 years, children are almost, people are almost protected because they naturally have had the disease. So it sort of is like a boost, but the problem still remains on how to protect the pediatric vaccine of that. So this is the dengue group. If you do the phylogeny by using the envelope protein, you get this, that Zika is actually the closest one from the dengue. Whereas if you do the phylogeny using the polymerase, for instance, you get that Zika clusters with West Nile and those encephalitic mosquitoes that are transmitted by these Culex mosquitoes. So this was an interesting finding, and I'll come back to that. But I just want to point that all of the serology studies whenever you have an infection from any flavivirus, an important fraction of the antibodies that you make are really broadly flavivirus cross-reactive, but do not exhibit significant neutralization. And yet, these antibodies can efficiently bind to the E protein, which is their main target. There was, for a while, historically, the flaviviruses were used to be called arboviruses, group B arboviruses, which were grouped together by the basis of their antigenic relationship, by this reaction that is called hemagglutinin inhibition. So you put the virus in the presence of erythrocytes, and you lower the pH. This is different because, and then the virus will expose, the envelope protein will expose this fusion loop that is important for fusion, and that would agglutinate erythrocytes. This is different to influenza hemagglutinin, which binds sialic acid, for instance. And so using this assay, they were using sera from people and see if they were cross-reactive, if they will inhibit this cross hemagglutination, then they were put in the same group or in the same. So this is how this group B was defined and turned to be arboviruses. This is what, back in 1975 when the genomes were not known. The E protein is the target for this HI assays. And it could also be found that cross-reactivity was also apparent in enzyme immunoassays using purified viruses. These are ELISA tests. What it turns out now is that this ELISA test, when you immobilize your target, the virus, there's always some denaturing, and you are exposing parts that are normally hidden in a well-conformed particle. But the neutralization assays were much more specific, and cross reactions in these assays are largely confined to groups that are much more closely related to flavivirus in terms of sero complexes. So just to summarize this, I think I go through this because it's important to what comes. So infection by a given flavivirus induces two functionally distinct populations of E protein-specific antibodies in the host. One that is strongly neutralizing, but it will only neutralize viruses that are very close to the one that you were infected to. And the other, that the ability to inhibit this hemagglutination of quite broadly. So with the amino acids difference in the E protein of less than 40%, which are the most distant flaviviruses known, but without having the significant neutralizing activity. So over the year, this had been the major questions on understand what are the epitopes of these potently neutralizing antibodies, and on the other one, those that are responsible for this broad cross-reactivity detected by hemagglutination inhibition, and found an explanation for that. So, and for that is where the structure comes, and now that we understand the structure, we understand many more things of that. So one of the things, I've been working all of my career on this, so this was from 1995, the first structure of a flavivirus was the tick-borne encephalitis, virus. And in the same laboratory, Steve Harrison at Harvard in 2003, they did the one from dengue. They are really, they look the same. You wouldn't tell them apart. So it's this E protein is a dimer, in which the fusion loop is what is indicated here in this light blue or cyan color. And it's buried at the interface of this dimer. What this protein is the membrane fusion protein, and this peptide, which is buried there, is the one that will insert into the target membrane when you expose the virus at acidic pH, as in the endosomes. So this, we know that acidic pH will lead to a dissociation of this dimer, and a reassociation into a trimer. And here we're missing the C-terminal part, but the transmembrane region will be there. So what this is doing is making a conformation, exposing this at the surface. So this is at the surface of the virus, will interact with the membrane, and then this conformational change and trimerization will bring the two segments, the one inserted in the endosomal membrane and the viral transmembrane segment that it was absent here, to the same side. And this is how all viral membrane fusion proteins work and have been. And it turned out that this form, we found the pre-fusion form or the active is quite different depending on different viruses, but the post-fusion form is always the same hairpin. And so we have gone on doing for different viruses now, rubella virus, the hantavirus, which is very recent. This is the flavivirus protein, the Semliki forest, which is very similar to the chikungunya virus proteins. All make this hairpin, in which this purple part is what goes to the transmembrane segment that is membrane anchored in the viral membrane initially. And these proteins have no sequence similarity, so it was not possible to predict from amino acids analysis. And we also found, and this goes because of this interesting talk on the origin of eukaryotes, we found that the only, at the time, the only eukaryotic cell-cell fusion protein that had been known was this one from C. elegans, involved in skin formation. And it turns out that it has exactly the same fold as everything. So we think that it is obvious that this derived from an ancestral common gene that had been used and transferred. Now it's not published yet. We have just solved the structure of the SHAP2 proteins, that is the gamete-specific, so it's the sex, is a protein that spends in the sperm, and which will fuse with an. So you can imagine that this sperm cell is like a little virus that will fuse, and the mechanism turns out to be the same. And this is also, the HAP2 protein has exactly the same fold. And so HAP2 is present in all of the different branches of the eukaryotic tree, and metazoans, protists, unicellular algae, in plants, in insects. It's in vertebrates, we cannot detect it by sequence alignment. I suppose it's there. So we think that this must have been sort of, I think one of the things that were not mentioned earlier today was the impact of viruses in the evolution of eukaryotic organisms. And I think that had been a major impact once those were generated in the evolution. You could see the placenta comes from the incorporation of retroviral genes, integration into the germline, which gave rise to Thierry Heitman, has supported to the appearance of placenta. And now we're finding more and more that these proteins that do these functions of cell-cell fusions have this one. But so this was a diversion, and just going back to the structure of dengue virus. How much time do I have? 15 minutes. 15 minutes, okay. That should be enough. So with the advent of cryo-electron microscopy, there had been a major revolution in the resolution of the things that you can see now. It was unthinkable like 10 or 15 years ago that you will get, by using electron microscopy, the trace, the polypeptide chain, and all of the amino acids. And it was easier first for icosahedral viruses, and this is the structure of dengue virus. Done at UCLA by Hong Zhao. There was a structure at lower resolution by Michael Rossman, in which he was able to fit this dimer that we had initially solved. But this is the actual structure revealed by electron cryomicroscopy. You see the symmetry, this was average. So you lose the RNA that is inside. You can sort of see the membrane, the leaflets, the transmembrane regions, and the coprotein. So the model, one of the things that is very interesting is that in order to get these structures, they needed to reject like 99% of the particles. So it's only 1% the well-performed particles that will remain. So this is an envelope virus. It's very fragile, and when you purify, you break them. So this is one of the things. So the model that we have is that this is the viral membrane. This is the subunit with the fusion loop. So these three domains, which are maintained in all viruses, now we're calling this class 2 proteins. The fusion loop is buried at this dimer interface. So there are the side chains, the hydrophobic side chains are packing against the other subunit. And you have 90 of these dimers that completely coat the surface of a mature virus. I'll come back to immature later. So you have actually three dimers packed in a row. And these facets, you have 30 of these facets that will make coat completely the membrane. So you don't see the membrane in this. So this will only, the membrane will be exposed only after exposure of low, to low pH, which will sort of open this dimer and will expose the fusion loop towards the membrane of the endosome and will trigger the conformational change and expose that. And another thing is because this protein has to react to low pH, it is maintained in a metastable state so that it can reach. So it's the minimum energy, and the low pH sort of lowers the barrier for it to fall into the lowest energy. But a corollary to that is that this protein is not as rigid as we see here. So this dimer is always fluctuating, or exposing or not. And this fusion loop that is buried there actually becomes exposed and actually is extremely immunogenic. And there are many antibodies that we develop in organisms are against this fusion loop. And those are very strongly enhancing when you, I will come back to that. So seeing from the side, the part that is buried in the membrane are all these helical parts that were not present in the structure. This is just showing structure. So the infection cycle of the virus is, so it will come, the immature virus will interact to some receptor. We don't know yet the receptors. Ali Amara have found some proteins, the TIM-TAM proteins that will interact with lipids in the membrane. There are other receptors that we know. DC sign is one of the receptors. This is the way the lectin will recognize the glycans. And when the mosquito bites you on the skin, the DC sign will migrate when they're infected and will bring the infection somewhere else. Yeah. But we don't know yet all of the repertoire of receptors because it doesn't match the different tissues that it can infect. So once the virus fuses in the some, there is replication, and then when there is enough replicated RNA, it will bud in the ER. And in the ER, you are at a neutral pH, and if you were to bud an active particle like this, when this is transported to the surface, you are exposed to acidic pH, and the virus wouldn't be able to live because it will fuse in there. So the way the virus changes that is that it's this second protein, which is PRM, that makes a complex with E, and it keeps it from fusing while it's there. And so the structure is quite different. There is a sort of a spiky particle that buds in the ER. When this particle is exposed to the acidic pH in the Golgi, it changes conformation to this smooth form. And upon that change of conformation, is exposed is cleavage site to furin, which is a late Golgi, trans-Golgi resident protease, which will cleave this PRM protein. And the segment that is left of PRM stays bound to the particle as long as the environment is acidic. But when the particle reaches the outer space, which is a neutral pH, this clipped part is released and you get a mature particle that can infect the site. But the thing is that many cells do not have enough furin to really, when you have, so the maturation status is only 60%, for instance, of the PRM is really clipped. So you have a mixture here of immature or immature. And in the immature patches, the fusion loop is exposed, and this is also triggering antibodies against this one. In addition, antibodies against PRM, which is uncleaved, are also non-neutralizing and facilitate the infection if you have. So, okay, this just summarizes the way dengue virus part buds in the mature cell, so I can go. The organization of the immature particle is very different, as I said. So here you have each trimer, where focusing on one trimer in which the PR part is on top, the fusion loop is right underneath, and these trimers are organized like that. And when, so this is what I just explained, when you add a neutral pH in the AR, you have this organization here. When it's exposed to low pH, it changes conformation. The cleavage site is accessible, and this yellow bean, this part of PRM, the globular part of PRM, it gets cleaved and it's released upon sorting. So it's quite a complicated, but the key point is that if you have incomplete PRM cleavage, you have very heterogeneous particles. And that is one of the problems. So, and this maturation extent is, it depends on cell type. I think I said of that, so I just re-up. So just to, the point is that the structure of the mature virion displaying dimers that are tightly packed is only a medium or time average structure. And mature dengue particles show a highly dynamic behavior. Many people have shown that, which it has to do with this metastability of the protein. And the vast majority of circulating dengue virions display regions that are built in a functional, well-structured dimers required for entry into cells. So this is where the virus particles that I just shown you. And here's sort of like an extreme breeding case which in which these dimers will be opening. And it inactivates. If you leave the infectious particles on the bench for several days, it is completely inactivated because this flickering of this breathing leads to its own inactivation. So, and these antibodies, that the most common found surface, they bind to the fusion loop. Actually, here is a structure by George Gao of a complex against those fusion loop antibodies. These are the ones that are poorly neutralizing and which induce ADE, antibody-dependent enhancement. And you see that it couldn't bind within the context of the dimer. So there are others. So this is the structure of the PRM. The fusion loop is still exposed in the complex with PRM, which is why you induce antibodies against this region that is immunogenic. Here there are other different antibodies binding to these fusion loop regions. And in addition, for instance, one of the things that was shown by Ted Pearson and others was the fact that some quick antibodies were using an antibody that binds to a site that is buried on the surface because it's at the packing of dimers. And just a mutation here completely changed the reactivity of these antibodies against the particle. And those changes map to the dimer interface. So this breathing will depend on serotypes, and sometimes single amino acids will change how much you breathe. I'm saying all this because it's important for the vaccine considerations from that. In addition, some evidence for breeding were shown that if you use an anti-fusion loop antibodies or an antibody to a cryptic, and you put the virus in complex with the antibodies for longer time before you add it into cells, you go decreasing. You need less antibodies and you increase. So these antibodies, there is a kinetic effect of exposure of the fusion loop as this dimer breed and expose the fusion loop, then the antibodies block it. But you need some time, and much longer than what you will need for a steady state. And this also gives rise to this what is called enhancement. The enhancement is measured on cells that are, for instance, here K562 cells that have the Fc gamma receptors, on which, if you have no antibodies, these cells are not infectable. And if you measure here the infectivity at a certain fraction of the antibody, you begin to have infectivity. And you get infection, and then when you put enough antibody, you neutralize against the infection. And this is by waiting also certain times, incubating with the antibodies. You see, you reduce the IC50, and you reduce the amount of enhancement that you find. And so this is a way, in order to neutralize a particle, you need a certain stoichiometry of antibodies surrounding these particles. If you expose, you have some breathing, and one or two of the dimers at the surface will expose the epitope, which is the fusion loop, then you will have a complex that it will be a kinetic status that you will need to have it long enough for it to completely coat the particles and neutralize. And when just one antibody, this will get incorporated into the endosome, and the virus will fuse from the opposite side. So the antibodies, the stoichiometry is not enough in order to obtain neutralization. And this is the mechanism by which we think the infection is enhanced. So the most potent neutralizing antibodies target sites readily accessible on virions. Without any requirement for breathing. Yes, that's right. For instance, Qin Zhulai and NIH, is a collaborator, had identified a very potently neutralizing antibody against dengue 4, which we crystallized, and we could see that it binds at a site that is really on the dimer without interfering with the dimer, and you could bind on the virion. So, until recently, all of the potent human antibodies isolated have been serotype specific like this, because the surface where it's exposed is the most variable part of the virus. So if you go from dengue 1 to dengue 2, it changes and the virus cannot trace. And the cross-reactive antibodies identified targeted linear epitopes like the fusion loop. So they were positive in Western blood, whereas this not. And they also generate this enhancement. So the challenge is to protect simultaneously against all four dengue serotypes. And here is where my collaborators, Gavin Scriton and Chutati Munkosapaya at the Imperial College, they were able to isolate antibodies from seven different patients. So they isolated 150 antibodies. Here, each line corresponds to one different monoclonal antibody that they isolated. So in red is the amount of antibody, 0.05 micrograms, that you will need to have this percentage of reduction of infectivity. And so it's 0.05, 0.5, or 5 micrograms per mL. And you see that for these antibodies here, that are, they were able to map them, the epitopes, this fusion loop and non-fusion loop, but we believe that are very similar to those fusion loop, because although the alanine scanning didn't find it, were very different to these that were conformational ones and are bound only to intact virions, or do you have to, or to the E dimer protein that is conformed. And these were able to neutralize at fewer amounts. I mean, even for instance, the red is going up almost at 90% of some of these EDE2, EDE1 and EDE2. So among all of the 150 antibodies, the majority were Western blot positive and targeting sites that are not exposed on the virion. Whereas a subfraction were like this. But if this was on virus that was grown on mosquito cells, C636, in which furin does a poor job cleaving, to have only 60% cleavage. Whereas if you grow the virus in dendritic cells, the furin does a very good job, and most of the virus particles is mature, it's much more difficult to neutralize. So these fusion loop antibodies were not even at the highest concentration, we're barely getting on one at 80%, whereas all of these others were still neutralizing at reasonable concentrations there. So on top of that, this was with dengue 2, they were able that, that they could neutralize all four serotypes. Zero here means 10 to the zero in nanomolars. It's quite a potent antibody for all the four serotypes as described here. There were two classes, which I was showing, EDE1 and EDE2. The only difference is the requirement for a glycosylation site at this position 153. With this one, didn't care. It's independent of having that. Whereas all of the rest of the alanine scanning gave exactly the same result otherwise. Whereas this one required the glycosylation. And here, this dengue 4, they realized later that it was a natural variant that was lacking this glycosylation site. So when they used another dengue 4, it was neutralized just the same way. And so we sort of solved the structure, identified the binding site, confirmed that the glycan was very important for these EDE2 antibodies, whereas the loop where the glycosylation site, although the epitope is very similar, is pushed away and is disordered in the structure. And this map to this region of the interface, here is where the antibody binds. So if you look down the arrow, you see this valley between the two. There are two glycosylation sites on dengue. This is the dimer interface. And the antibody sort of, here, the EDE2 contacting the glycans and the EDE1. There are two different ones. The star means that that loop that has the glycosylation is disordered, and they can also reach. But they reach this epitope, which is an extremely conserved part of the exposed part. So here, everything that is variable is white, and the main chain, which doesn't vary because you cannot mutate the main chain unless having insertions, or conserved side chains are orange, and yellow are highly similar, for instance, leucine or isoleucine. Or stuff. So there is a spot at this region. And this region, so the green is the EDE2 epitope, and black is the EDE1. This blue circle sort of indicates where PRM binds during mature, in the immature particle, which is here in pink, which is exactly the same site. So the structure was solved by Marie-Christine, it's very recent, on tick-borne encephalitis virus, but they all look the same. So so when I told you that the immature virus buds like this in the ER, when the pH is lower, you make a dimer with exposing the furin cleavage site, and then furin cleaves, and this is what we get. So this is the complex of PRM and E. And if you do an open book and examine the surface from conservation to neutral to very variable, you see that this is the more spotted surface. So the apparently these antibodies have found an exposed site, which is sort of like we call the Achilles heel of this virus, because it's targeted and it's the same in all four dengue serotypes. And now, because we had like Zika virus is appear like the closest one by looking at the envelope protein, we tried the same. So we took all of the dengue antibodies that we had, found that the FLE will bind to the recombinant protein very tightly. This EDE1 about a log less strongly, so these are binding sites with bilayer interferometry, and the EDE2 even less. And this is understandable because the loop that has the glycosylation site on Zika is different, so the virus requires that, the antibody requires that to binding, and the binding is less, much poorer. And so Giovanna Barba-Spetz in the lab did the neutralization experiments. The fusion loop antibodies that I had shown for dengue virus did not really, they could neutralize dengue virus as shown here, not that bad, but for Zika, the two strains, and one is in blue, the Western Pacific strain, and the other one is the African strain that had been attenuated over the years. And so the one that is attenuated is very easily neutralized. But even the one circulating now in blue, it was neutralized even stronger than to dengue virus here on this structure. And the EDE2, because they didn't, it was sort of an intermediate result as well. But these antibodies were extremely interesting. So we went on to do the structure. Here, I think I have to wrap up, right, Philippe? So I will not go into all of the details. So we have a huge amount of information on the structures. We can do exactly see every side chain, every interactions, and we can sort of understand now by having crystal structure with the Zika protein, with the dengue protein from all of the four serotypes, what are the regions of interaction of these antibodies. So this is to summarize. One thing, what we saw is that now that the cryo-EM structure of the Zika virus is available, this curvature is the same, whereas the dengue virus is much more malleable, and we think it has to do with its breeding. You see, if you compare them, these are the epitopes, which are obviously the same. The main determinant is this B strand, and all of the important contacts are all conserved. So the curvature, it's the dengue virus E-dimer is much more metastable and malleable, which we think is one of the cause of the problems for dengue virus. So we have done two different antibodies with this, so I'll just skip. One of the things I wanted to mention is that in parallel, our colleagues in London were able to show that all of the dengue, for instance, the convalescent, the serum for convalescent people, all enhance the infection by Zika virus, and that doing tests of enhancement, they also, you find any antibody will enhance if you put it at concentrations that are less than the IC50. So this is what you're showing here, but the EDE1, Whereas the EDE2, zero is here, you see what, and zero, 1 nanomolar, you already don't have anymore. Whereas here you still have quite a lot, and it's the same for the fusion loop antibodies. So one possibility is to treat, is to put this mutation on the Fc such that it cannot interact with the Fc gamma receptors, these LALA receptors that are known, that can be used for to protect pregnant women, for instance, from contracting Zika. And so what this triggered us is that we think that now it's possible to use a single immunogen instead of putting all four proteins, which is this region that protecting there, and then doing a resurfacing or something like I've done for HIV, GP120, in order to avoid. Now that we know that Zika is all completely different here, so we could start with the Zika protein, this is what we are trying to do, and engineer disulfide to stabilize this one to make sure that it doesn't open, so we have results already, and we're trying to move forward into presenting this. We were talking with Rino Rapoli, which we are seeing. So, on conclusions, the most potent neutralizing antibodies target epitopes available at the surface without this breeding requirement. Our study points to one such site that is conserved across serotypes, and if we could consider Zika like a member of a super serogroup now, it's an apparent Achilles heel of a vulnerability site. And the structure suggests that an epitope-focused vaccine design is possible to engineer a single immunogen in the form of a stabilized E-dimer for subunit vaccine development to elicit preferentially, so this type of thing. So these are the people. Alex, he was a wonderful postdoc. Now he's back at Jerusalem University, and he has a position there. Pablo Guardado Calvo, Giovanna Barbaspet, Marie-Christine, Stéphane Ducarroy, Xiao Kang. He's the one first author on that cryo-EM structure of the whole dengue particle when he was in UCLA. And now, unfortunately, he was also offered a position in China. And Gavin Scriton and Jutatip, who were collaborators with Nui and Hua. And this is the funding. Thank you.